Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations now bring you an address by the Honorable Dean Acheson, Acting Secretary of State. Mr. Acheson.
I should like to talk with you this afternoon about what the United States has done and proposes to do to help other peoples who are in need of relief. When I was a boy, there was a character in fiction and on the stage who was supposed to be a typical American. He usually announced early in the story that he could lick his weight in wildcats and that his country was the biggest, the finest, and the most ingenious country in the world. I look back on him with nostalgic affection when I read and listen to more contemporaneous Americans apologizing for the best things this country does or attacking it before other countries because their own views are not accepted at home. In telling this story this afternoon, I'm going to call witnesses who have nothing whatever to do with government. One of our historic American rights is to maintain perpetual open season on the unhappy occupants of public office. So my first witness is going to be Mr. Wallace R. Duell of the Chicago Daily News, who was given, so his editors tell us, a 6 weeks assignment to report on what America has done for other countries. In the issue of the Chicago Daily News for November 15, 1946, Mr. Duell states the problem in this way. He says, when World War II ended, 19 countries lay prostrate and dying. The peoples of these countries numbered almost a billion, approximately one half of the human race. Europe was like a charnel house, and so was a large part of Asia. Tens of millions were gaunt with hunger and disease. They ached with cold, crawled with vermin, shook with fever. The world had slaughtered almost 14 million of its best men and women in uniform and wounded almost 31 million more. Another 27 million were missing or prisoners of war. Total civilian casualties were probably at least as high as those in the armed forces. 6 million civilians were killed in Poland alone. The war had driven 77 million human beings into alien areas. Tens of thousands of children had been so completely lost that they did not even know who their parents were, or where their homes had been, or their own names, or nationalities, or the mother tongues they had spoken. And neither did anyone else know these things. The war had destroyed 15 million dwellings and seriously damaged 30 million more. Tens of millions of people had no place to live. More than 25 million human beings were living in caves, dugouts, ruined buildings, and holes in the ground in White Russia alone when the war ended, and more than 800,000 in Poland. Whole nations were wearing their last threadbare clothes. Whole nations had little or no fuel to keep them warm. Starvation faced 800 million human beings when the war ended, two-fifths of the human race. Such is Mr. Duell's report. I now ask Mr. Duell how this problem was met. He replies from the same article in this way. Only one country could give the hitherto undreamed of help necessary to save the world, the United States. It did give it. America has contributed more than $3,342,000,000 in foreign relief. This has been made up as follows. Given to UNRWA, $2,700,000,000. Donated through the American Red Cross, $178,000,000. Raised and distributed by 93 other private relief organizations, $464,000,000. Making the total of $3,342,000,000. This contribution is almost 2¾ times as large as the whole United States public debt in the year 1916. This is the end of the quotation from Mr. Duell. Now, all this was given free. And may I add this to Mr. Duell's answer? Of all the food received by importing countries in the year from July 1945 to June 1946, whether purchased or received as a gift, one half came from one country, the United States of America. But this is only a small fraction of what this country has made available to the world in the past 6 years. Let Mr. Jewell testify again, and I quote him. Besides its enormous outright contributions to relief, the United States has made available to the rest of the world since before Pearl Harbor, or committed itself to do so, the staggering total of more than $66,385,000,000 in various other forms. America has done this under the following principal headings. Lend-lease, $51 billion. British credit, $3,750,000,000. Total foreign credit authorizations by the Export-Import Bank, $3,458,000,000. The United States quota in the World Bank, $3,175,000,000. The United States quota in the World Fund, $2,750,000,000. Civilian supplies sent to liberated and occupied areas, $1,400,000,000. Credits advanced to finance sales of United States surplus property abroad, $851,000,000. Mr. Jewell's testimony ends here. This was the price of victory and of the survival of civilization after victory. It is no disparagement of the great gallantry and indispensable contribution of any of our allies to say that neither victory nor survival of many millions was possible without this American contribution. Its magnitude may be roughly measured by saying that it is equal to the entire production of this country for any year in the decade before the war. Everything that 140 million people grew or dug out of the earth or made in all their factories and shops and homes. And over two-thirds of it was given without any request for payment. The tangible riches of a country consist of its people, of its national resources, and of its facilities for the production and distribution of useful goods. During the war and after it, we depleted the storehouses which nature left on this continent. We ran down our machines and our transport to give to all the armies and civilian populations fighting the Axis the tools with which to win the war. America came out of the war poorer than when she went into it by this vast effort and by the loss of hundreds of thousands of her finest sons. And so when anyone says to you that America grew rich out of the war, or wishes to enslave other peoples by handouts, you are not to be blamed if you reply in the single word with which General McAuliffe replied to Field Marshal von Rundstedt's demand for surrender at Bastogne. Now, with this perspective, let us return to relief. The United States took the lead in calling together in Atlantic City on November 10, 1943, representatives of the Allied and Associated Countries to consider relief problems and to make preparations to meet them. At this meeting, the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, which has since become known as UNRWA, was born. The creation of UNRWA will go down in history as the greatest organized humanitarian achievement of all time. UNRWA has already shipped over 18 million tons of supplies, and an additional 5 million tons are in process of shipment, making a total of 23 million tons before the program will have been completed. America has produced and shipped nearly three-fourths of all these supplies. Now, UNRWA was organized primarily to do two things for the liberated countries. First, to supply foreign purchasing power to those countries which themselves lacked the means to pay for needed supplies. And secondly, to supply an organization to procure and ship and to deliver these supplies. At the end of the war, chaos threatened in some countries. There were no governments adequately staffed to collect or buy supplies. There was no food, there was no medicine, and no transportation to distribute them. UNRWA was designed to step into this breach, and it did so magnificently. But in the very nature of things, the administration of UNRWA was not and could not have been free of serious faults. In an organization such as UNRWA, composed of representatives of 48 nations, each with one vote, it was natural that the representative of each country claiming free relief should get all that he could for his country. In many cases, his political life depended upon his success or failure in this effort. UNRWA's programs of relief are passed upon by a central committee composed of representatives of 9 nations. The 3 nations which have contributed about 95% of all UNRWA's operating funds are represented on the committee and have 1 vote each, or 1/3 of the total voting strength in the committee. So some nations got relief whose needs were not sufficiently critical to warrant it. Other nations got more than their needs justified. Still others got less. Let us return to the taking of testimony and produce an exhibit. In the New York Times of Sunday, December 1st, a map of Europe is published indicating the combined food, fuel, clothing, and housing situation in Europe. The condition of each country is indicated by 4 types of shading, from the worst to the best. Only 5 countries are shown as best. One of these countries is today receiving free relief from UNRWA in a very large amount. 2 other countries, shown as next to the best, are also receiving free relief from UNRWA. Another country, which is shown on this map as worst, while it is receiving free relief from UNRWA, is not obtaining nearly as much relief as conditions justify. I'm now going to present a witness from a country which is receiving UNRWA assistance. Recently, the Ministry of Foreign Trade of a country referred to as best in the New York Times map issued an economic bulletin. The bulletin shows that during the past 2 or 3 months, over 200,000 tons of potatoes were exported, with an additional 125,000 tons to be exported in the near future. The country in question has repeatedly requested shipments of milk and fats from UNRWA. The bulletin, however, reports that before the war, the country manufactured 80 truckloads of cheese per month, whereas during the summer of 1946, 160 truckloads of cheese per month were manufactured. The bulletin further states that production of cheese has been sufficient to meet all domestic requirements, even though the consumption of cheese has increased greatly over pre-war figures. Now, no country should be given free relief unless it has adopted all reasonable measures to help itself. Under any impartial application of this test, some of the UNRWA countries would be ruled out. For instance, if a country is maintaining a large army which has to be fed and supplied and which is non-productive, should such a country be eligible for free relief? The maintenance of such an army may be the right of any country, just as any country may experiment as it chooses with its economic system, even though doing so may play havoc with its own production. But in that case, should it ask or expect gifts of food and supplies from other countries? Should a country expect other countries to furnish it with tractors and agricultural implements at a time when it is employing its own manufacturing facilities for building tanks and other weapons of warfare? Let me call a final witness, this time an editorial writer in the New York Times of November 18, 1946. This witness testifies as follows. Not only have some of the receiving countries raised the cry of American economic imperialism and accused the United States of using food as a political weapon, but the governments of countries loudest in their demand for relief have preferred to carry out a political and economic revolution at the risk of starving their own people instead of centering their efforts on recovery and reconstruction. They have stripped large parts of Europe of their agricultural and industrial equipment, and in some parts even of population, and have left them 1.5 years after the cessation of hostilities a howling wilderness. They have impaired the production of Europe's agricultural surplus areas by a precipitate land division, which destroyed the larger farms that used to produce the surplus and gave the peasant less land than necessary for him to live on, and no tools to work it with. Finally, they have indulged in such revolutionary methods of nationalization, economic control, and currency inflation coupled with the liquidation of the former managerial class, that they have produced mass unemployment, black markets, and hoarding by the peasants of what little they do produce. This witness continues, "This does not and cannot mean that the world's hungry should be left to starve. In some fashion, they must and will be fed. We are confident that the United States will do its part in that. But the time has come to consider how far the humanitarian efforts of the democracies shall be used to subsidize, however indirectly, governments and armies which preempt their own nation's resources for political purposes." So he testifies. The United States is pressing forward in the United Nations with an international organization to care for, repatriate, or resettle refugees. This is because the facts warrant such an organization. They warrant it because refugees of many different nationalities are presently being cared for in a number of countries and will have to be repatriated or resettled in still different countries. To accomplish this most effectively and quickly requires rather complicated arrangements of finance and movements of hundreds of thousands of people, in which many countries have to participate. The plan of this government calls for the organized participation of those nations which are now responsible for the refugees and those which may be willing to receive them. But the United States does not believe that post-war UNRWA relief should be conducted by an UNRWA type of organization. This again is based upon the facts. It is now quite evident that many countries which, when liberated, had no organized machinery for procuring and shipping needed supplies, are now able to perform these services for themselves. And the sooner these countries take over the complete responsibility for their own buying and shipping, the better it will be for them and for everybody concerned. When a country can do these things for itself, it can usually do them better and cheaper than any international organization which may be set up for that purpose. UNRWA's other function was the provision of foreign money to countries which lacked the means to pay for food or other imported supplies. A moment's reflection should convince anyone that there has been a vast improvement in this field also. Most of the liberated countries are gradually regaining their export trade. And in addition to this normal method of providing foreign purchasing power, the United States and other countries have, by loans and otherwise, added enormously to the foreign exchange resources of the world. In the past 18 months, the United States government alone has supplied foreign exchange in the following important ways. $3 billion through loans by the Export-Import Bank. $3.75 billion credit to the British government, which will be spent all over the world. $6 billion as the United States contributions to the Bretton Woods Institution. Several billions of dollars credit for financing lend-lease inventories and pipelines and the sales abroad of surplus property on credit. So, including contributions to UNRWA, the United States government has made available a total of nearly $20 billion to assist in restoring and stabilizing the economies of other countries. Many other countries also have contributed to the capital of the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development and to the International Monetary Fund. Indeed, these two institutions will have at their disposal some $15 billion with which to give assistance to United Nations countries having need of such assistance for reconstruction, for development, and for the stabilization of their currencies. These two international financial institutions have now been organized and are ready for work. So it will be seen that measures have been definitely taken for the provision of a total of about $30 billion in foreign exchange. Now let us be clear about another essential fact. It is this. Because there is or may be great need or actual starvation in any country, it does not follow that that country necessarily lacks the funds to purchase what it needs. The suffering which occurred last winter through lack of necessary food was caused primarily because there was not enough food in the world to go around, and because the internal and ocean transport was not capable of moving what there was fast enough. India, for instance, suffered greatly from lack of food. But India was at all times ready and willing to pay for food and did pay for it. The basic obstacle was that there wasn't enough food to buy, and that railroads and ships could not move food fast enough. Now it's been charged that the United States is abandoning international cooperation in refusing to participate in relief on an international basis. It has also been charged that the United States intends to use food as a political weapon. The plan of the United States for continuation of such relief as may be necessary in the year 1947 is very simple indeed. It should be remembered that comparatively few countries will continue to require relief after the early months of 1947 when UNRWA completes its task. There will probably be only three or four countries in Europe which can qualify as requiring free relief in order to avoid suffering and hardship. The United States proposal is that each nation should immediately consider what it can contribute to the common cause of 1947 relief. The administration here will recommend to Congress a generous appropriation for this purpose. Each country should discuss its plans with others, both those who are planning to help and those who need help, to obtain their views, to coordinate their activities with all others concerned. The Secretariat of the United Nations should be used as a clearinghouse by all these countries. The United States will keep the Secretary General fully informed of what it is doing, and others should do the same. In this way, nations receiving free relief must prove their need for it, and they can be held to a much closer and fairer accountability of the use of food and other free supplies. Those in power will be compelled to distribute relief food on the basis of need. They will not be allowed to feed their political supporters and starve their political opponents. The people of the United States and the Congress of the United States have made up their minds that the relief problems of the near future are not of a character which warrant grants of enormous sums of money from the United States Treasury under conditions which leave little or no effective control by the grantor of these funds. The people of the United States are determined that they will not send free shipments of great quantities of food, tractors, trucks, and other supplies of all kinds, many of which they desperately need themselves, to countries which are diverting their manpower and facilities away from the production of the necessities of life which they are asking other people to supply. Now, if the American people can be led to believe that this policy constitutes the use of food as a political weapon, then they do not deserve their reputation for native shrewdness and common sense.
You have heard an address by the Honorable Dean Acheson, Acting Secretary of State. Mr. Acheson spoke from Washington, D.C. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.